I'm Barbara Ross, and it's Sunday, February the 20th, and we're here for a second interview and conversation with Florence Fredericks, also known as Winky, which is her preferred name. So, Winky, we have a series of questions that we're going to ask, and we'll begin by going back just a little bit to the previous conversation we had with you. I want you to talk a little bit more about your art. You've done many things with your art. You've done it in many places, and you've done it in with many different mediums. So I want you to talk more about your art.
It was all I knew, art. I wasn't good at typing or doing anything like that. But mother had painted. She went to Washington University in St. Louis, and she was a very, very decent artist until she married my father. And then she had me. And I remember vaguely she had a lavender satin bedspread and she was painting and I was on the bed. And I somehow managed to turn over her linseed oil and turpentine on that lovely new bedspread. And I think that's when mother gave up art. Although she did pick it up later. We had a horse and we were very active with the horse people. We had a great three-headed sorrel horse. And she started painting horses for people. But by that time I was through kicking over her turpentine. And she had some little recognition as the painter of horses. So this is where I come from with art. And besides doing it for fun, when I was widowed, I decided, well, maybe I'm going to have to get some income around here. So I took up graphic design and opened a studio in Covington, Louisiana, and made a fair living at that. It's interesting that my first studio was in an old building that had been the servants' quarters, which was behind the Art Association in Covington, Louisiana. And I had this dear friend, Walker Percy, and his wife, Butt. Walker was quite a well-known author at the time, and he took one of these little apartments for his writing hideaway. And there was another one empty, and his wife called Azura at the time, and she said, Winky, you've got to rent that studio, because who knows what is going to move into it. There was a woman involved. So I came home, went home to Covington, and rented the studio. And I worked out of that studio next door to Walker for over a year. And then I went on to other things. But the painting, I hate to tell you, I painted what people wanted. I did the craziest things. I'd retouch old paintings. I would do original works. I painted people's sailboats. I sketched their homes for their Christmas cards. I did everything under the sun. I designed the kneelers for our Episcopal church to go with the antique building, and banners. I did banners. Oh my goodness. I did design stained glass, you name it. It was very rewarding, and I could do that in the daytime and be home by the time the children were out of school. So that's my art career. And then when we moved up here, well, I went into China painting. But in the meantime, we had already lived in Iowa, and I had exhibited fine art there. And I'd exhibited back in Arkansas to a certain extent, too, more serious paintings. But when you're working for income, you work for income.
Talk a little bit more about your fine artworks. I know that you've had art shows and been shown in various galleries around the country. Say a little bit more about that. For one thing, I know that you have had a show at the Ashby Hodge in Fayette, Missouri. So where
Oh,
and
of
where
course,
else?
yes. Oh, yes. And then there was a gallery over at Rocheport for some time, and I had shows there. But I had slowed up by the time we moved to Missouri. I had married again, and income wasn't such a factor. But as I was saying, when my husband came down with Alzheimer's, I needed something to do to stay in the house with him. I couldn't go out to where the easels and all the smelly paints were, so I took up this china painting, and I did a lot of souvenirs for occasions, Lewis and Clark anniversary, one thing and another. You had to do 200 at a time for most of these worthy causes, and so it kept the kiln going full time. The way I did it, I would do the drawing and send it to California somewhere, made into decals, and then you'd moisten the decals and put them on the porcelain, fire it, then you paint it, fire it again. It's very tedious, and but it was fun.
How many gallery shows do you think you've had in your lifetime? And when you say you did fine art, talk more about what you mean by fine art.
That's not a very simple question. Fine art is when you paint it to hang it. It's an expression of some great inner feeling or something. And you express yourself with oil paint, acrylic paint, stuck on fabrics, charcoal, whatever. It's more personal. The art that helps you make a living is different. I want a painting of my dog, for instance. I need this picture of my 5-year-old baby. There's a lot of that. Or you paint sailboats in when you're in Louisiana. When you're in Iowa, you paint cornfields. When you're in Missouri, you paint china. I'm a very practical person, and I have a lot to express. One show in particular I did in Louisiana, I had never been to the Southwest before. And here was coming from green Louisiana into the desert area where where you never see green. You'll see blue sky, but you'll rarely see an honest to goodness green. Was quite a shock. So I did a show in Louisiana of these sort of desert scenes. They didn't sell very well, but it was an interesting show. I had the music that was playing in the background was Paul. He had a Canyon Suite. Oh dear, he's a composer from Boulder, Colorado. Paul Winter, that's his name. He did a wonderful Canyon series from the canyon. He took his little orchestra down into the Grand Canyon, and you can hear a plane go by in that recording that he made in the canyon. But I'm getting off the subject. That's enough of art. If any of my art survives, wonderful. If not, I'm not. I wasn't at it for the fame.
Well, I think that though that you are a known artist, Winky, and people would like to collect your paintings and have your paintings, and people now consider them valuable art. So, and even some of the things that you consider just your graphic art that you may have done just for financial reasons, I think now perhaps those things are valuable. And if you're any signed art that's out there that's around, anyone would be more than thrilled to have some of that art, and it would be worth a considerable amount of money.
May I hire you for an agent?
Well, I've looked you up online, and I know that you have you are a known artist. And okay, well, let's go on, and we did talk about your art school training, did we not? You want to say a little more about the training?
Sort of hit or miss. I graduated in art from Ward Belmont Junior College Girls School in Nashville, Tennessee. I took a degree in Bachelor of Art at the University of North Carolina. They did not give a degree in fine art. Mm-hmm. So I took a bachelor's. Then I studied in England at St. Martin's. It was a wonderful way to study, because if you wanted to do figure drawing, there was a figure drawing department. If you wanted to do sculpture, anything. I don't believe they had a degree. I think it was sort of like the Art Students League, which I attended in New York for a while. It's you go in and you have what you need to know. Like down in the basement of the Art Students League, they had, I hate to admit it, but they had all these old tombstones and hunks of sandstone, and the sculpture students would rework these ancient tombstones. It was sort of sad. But anyway, I'd spent a while up there.
Winky, what other mediums did you work in other than, say, oils and acrylics and drawing? Did you do sculpture work?
Oh, I've tried that. Oh, yes, my, yes, and casting and different. I've tried nearly everything, I think, but I'm trying to think of something I haven't tried. Photography and silk screen, like Andy Warhol. He did a great series with silk screening, but I've never done that.
Well, tell us how you would describe your art.
Sentimental realism.
Okay.
With as much abstraction as I can put, I have a feeling for.
I want to change gears a little bit and talk about the family home here and this old plantation that's called Pleasant Green. So talk a little bit about the history of Pleasant Green and how your family is connected to that history.
It all started in Kentucky. The family was in Bourbon County, and the West was opening up 1806 or 9, I can't remember. Anyway, so young Winston married Polly Ruby and started a life in Kentucky. But once it opened up, Winston decided he wanted to come out, and he took his three boys and one nephew and a couple of, I understand, black help, and they would come out in the summertime and explore, mess around. They built a fort at this juncture here, roughly where Georgetown Road makes a bend and heads west toward the southwest.
On Highway 135, right? What is now known as Highway 135.
Georgetown Road was never paved. That was the main route. I don't know why they blacktopped 135, because you're crossing all these little old streams. Georgetown Road, you only have about two or three water stops that are shallow enough to pull your wagon through. Of course, the Lamine is a deep river. That's tricky. There's always been a bridge at the Lamine River, but most of the other streams you can drive through on the old road.
What year would this have been when they came? It was the probably the 18 teens when they came from
Well,
Kentucky to Missouri.
some have said 1818,
It
but
wouldn't Missouri wouldn't even have been a state then. We
oh
weren't
no,
even a
oh no,
state.
that didn't come to what, 23, 1823.
1821, something like that
I
now.
think it was well in the 20s, yeah. But there were people out here
Of course.
staking claims. The story in the family is that Sam Walker, this is one of the first Sam Walker, had some Spanish land here, and that he was trying to convert it to the American way of recording. But I have never researched that. I do not know. But the
Well, the Louisiana Purchase was made from Spain, from King Ferdinand
Spanish,
and
right, not
was,
French, Spanish.
yeah, you said, but it was made from King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella. That was the
Right.
Louisiana Purchase. And, but at the time of that purchase, which was the early 1800s, there was no such state as Missouri. But
Right. Oh,
your
no, you're
family
right.
came from Kentucky to
Out here.
Missouri, probably by about 1810 or the
No,
18
no, no. It'd
teens.
be later, because people were all roiled up with the French and Indian War and the war with Mexico and whatnot. I think they just came out here to look around and stake the claim. Their patent is dated 1823, which is when they really made things legal. And it was for, I think, 80 or 120. The patent, the grant is on the wall in the hall. I hate to say my American history isn't too good, but they did build a fort. The Osage Line was just west of here. See, they had made the Osage move out.
The native
They just
inhabitants,
drew a
the
line,
Osage Indians.
and it was not too far west of here. And so that's why they started with a little fort. And I'm sure they made several trips back and forth. But that hill over there has a lot of clay in it, and they could make their own brick. I'll show you where the first house was, and the ladder to go up into the attic where the boys slept. There's a little window up there, and we'll look at that later. And then Polly did not want to come. Polly did not want to
Let's
come.
go back just a little bit before we get off of this. You said these men came that were your ancestors from Kentucky, and they had with them these African Americans, what we now would call these Negroes, with them. And were they their slaves? Had they were they purchased these? Do you know that?
Well, the custom was in the fam, the Walkers, and I think in sort of in general, that when you married, say when Winston married Polly, Polly's parents gave her a slave to help her in her married life. The black people that were here came through marriages. From the Reeds, two Reed girls came with two or three black people. In Kentucky, for years, you could not sell black people unless you had trained them in a craft or some sort of apprenticeship so they could take care of themselves and not, as they say in those days, not be a drain on the local coffers, that they could support themselves, or the late owner could support them, have to have an allowance or something.
But
Kentucky was peculiar.
when your family came to Missouri, they brought certain amount of slaves
Oh,
with them.
yes.
So, and Pleasant Green was where they were established, and there was a long history of slaves here on Pleasant Green.
I have a book out there of the ones listed in the census. Mm. I think they started out with two or three, and then Polly's, and then, of course, when their son married Mary Elizabeth Reed, she brought several with her. The Reeds lived.
And they lived here on the plantation.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Pleasant Green.
Oh, yes. They had buildings in the back. Of course, those buildings came later.
Those were the slave quarters.
Log buildings at first. This was a rough life. They were here in this spot because there was water down the hill. And the land was tillable. People that came later could stay up on top of the hill because they had developed the turning plow. They could dig cisterns. They had it more refined. But the early people had to be near water to survive.
What year was this plantation home built?
We figured that this one room, which was probably, I'll show you how that goes, was here by 1820.
Really? That's that early.
And then, very, very poorly made brick.
And then how many years before other parts of the home were constructed?
Well, we figure the part across the front was about 1830.
Mm-hmm. Because, and what about the room we're sitting in, which you now use as dining room?
This came more like 1850, 1860.
So the house was built in stages.
Oh,
and
the
original home was just this part, which you now use as kind of a parlor here, just this small, about 12 by 12, 15 by 15 room.
It could have been two rooms because the original floor, when you come in, that's the split log flooring. Uh-huh. Which was probably in this room as well. Mm-hmm. But the later owners took up that log floor and dug a nicer cellar and concreted it and then put back a standard floor.
So the plantation that is called Pleasant Green was built over a period of about 30 years.
At least,
maybe longer.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Beginning in about 1820.
There have been several versions of that kitchen, because the kitchen was outside. Mm-hmm. It was a separate building, if you could see it in the illustration.
Yes, and there were slave quarters out back behind. Right. What else was at Pleasant Green?
Well, of course, a lot of farm buildings. For a while, we had a very fine hexagonal barn that was built in about 1910, which was a joy to behold. But the elements took it down about 10 years ago. The only original building left from the early days would be that little red shed in the backyard. That was their smokehouse. It was a place to dry tobacco. We use it to store the kayaks. I just recently had the metal put over it because I didn't want to disturb it, because it has heavy wooden sills and big, nice, wide boards, but I couldn't take it down, so I just covered it up with metal. The outhouse dates to probably about 1850, 1860, as this one remaining cabin. When the Schlotzauer family bought the property at the courthouse door in about 1916 or 17, they did not like having people in those cabins. They call them cabins.
They were the slave quarters.
Yeah, they were still living here. And so they didn't want the people here. So they moved a couple of them down the road for rental to anybody else. And they burned probably one, and then we have one left. And the only reason we have it is because the lady and her daughter that were living there did not want to go to Sedalia like the others did, because she had a young girl. And Sedalia was a pretty rough town, particularly for black people. It was, you know, the railroad had finally made it to Sedalia, and all by the 1900s, and so the Schlotzauer family told her if she worked for Mrs. Schlotzauer, she and her daughter could stay until she was old enough to go to school and be safe in Sedalia. So that's why we have only one left.
So on into, after the Civil War and slavery was no longer the law of the land here, you still had families that were the subsequent generations of those slaves that stayed here at Pleasant Green and lived on Pleasant Green as a plantation for maybe, what, another 60 years after the Civil War?
The war was over 64.
In 1865?
You're right, about 45 years. Yeah. The men could work at the quarry. There's a wonderful old quarry southwest of here that was developed to put the grounding in for the Katy Railroad. And that was a good job.
Put in a bedding.
I can't remember the bed. What you call it. But anyway, they worked, and of course there was always laundry and stuff to do and hogs to take care of in the wintertime. I have no idea.
Do you know if after the Civil War the blacks that continued to live here, were they ever paid, or did they just continue to live here and help work on the plantation?
That I cannot tell you.
Okay.
I do know that a lot of them left. A cousin of mine has researched one of the black ladies, Lucinda, and Lucinda left. Lucinda married. She had some children, and she moved up to Pilot Grove. We don't know what she did for a living. I have not done my own research. I'm depending on my cousin, but Lucinda is the only one we have tracked. But there are descendants in Sedalia, and I thought I had a wonderful opportunity to talk to some of the members, the descendants, but the leading spokesperson for this family didn't want to talk. The local black people had a wonderful church down that road, and a little house for the minister, which was used for a school until the county built a little school in that area called Mount Moriah. That was the neighborhood that developed after the war. Now, I know Uncle Ad gave parcels to some of the men if they wanted to farm. And those were all bought up in the 30s by the Gerke family. And they closed the road. So used to be quite a settlement is now just one big farm, and you can't get over there.
Are there any remnants of those early slaves that were here on Pleasant Green Plantation? Are there remnants?
Well, they're buried up at Mount Moriah. And then first they were buried down here, down the hill, in the little church. You've seen the church. It's right behind the house. And the old cemetery has many of the residents.
So there are some tombstones, but are there any any others that live in this general vicinity of those original slaves that were here on Pleasant Green? Do any of those people live in this area now?
Not in the last few years. Mm-hmm. For a while, but Kansas City has more to offer. and Sedalia. I don't know of Pilot Grove had a sizable community. They had a Baptist church they built. They had a little cemetery.
And you're saying this was an African American or a black
Yeah, up in
church.
Pilot Grove, right, because a lot of them moved into town. And when the railroad did come through, the Pullman porter lived there and raised a family. They had a nice community. But sadly, all traces of that are gone, of their little church. Just deteriorated. And as far as I know, I don't think we have any black families left.
How big was Pleasant Green at its acreage wise? How large was it in its largest holdings?
I hate to admit, I don't know. 600 was the last number I think I arrived at. I must show you.
600 acres. It was 600 acres at
Yeah.
one point.
And then it was divided for Henry up the hill. That's where Vicki lived. And they lopped off some for Sam was over that way, and William Walker was over that way. It was
It
parceled
sold
out.
off in parcels in subsequent decades.
Right.
And today, how large is Pleasant Green?
7 acres.
7 acres. Okay.
And
Okay.
that's enough for me.
Very good. Very good. Okay. I wanted you to talk a little bit about the social, religious, and community associations that you have in your lifetime here. Well, before we talk about that, let's talk about when your family has roots in this plantation, and then it was sold to another family, to some other people, and you came back to this plantation and purchased it again. Is that correct? And tell us that little history then.
Yeah, well, it was sold at the courthouse door in the early 1900s, and Uncle Ed and Aunt Maggie were allowed one suitcase, and so they took their suitcases and moved into a boarding house in Sedalia. The whole place was sold at the courthouse door to a James Schlotzauer, and the Schlotzauers took over furniture,
And
everything.
what year would this have been, or approximately?
Let's say 1916. It was bound to happen. The people out here all loaned each other money. We had a little bank up here in the town of Pleasant Green. One of the Walkers was a cashier, but they had a big robbery, and if you can imagine a bank robbery in a little bitty old town like that. But the IOUs in the probate records would break your heart, because they were, and they were all, they always had a bank panic going on somewhere. So the Schlotzauers bought it and lived here until they kind of went on to better things in about the I guess the 50s or 60s, and they didn't want this big old house. They took their furniture and
Did they farm this?
oh
They
yes,
farmed the
there was
plantation.
still a lot of, oh yeah, there was,
So
I
let me
think it
put
was
this
about
in a,
probably 300 acres.
let's see if I can put this in just a little bit of context. So you're saying that by the early 1900s, at least the 19 teens, the whole plantation economy that was based on having slaves and all, that had collapsed.
Bound to. And the
And
banks that.
that your family that had owned that and owned the plantation until then, they sold it then to the Schlotthauers.
Well,
And
it was sold by the county
okay, I was sold at
at
the
the
courthouse
courthouse
step.
door. Grassmead went bankrupt. For some reason, Henry Walker up the hill, he made it. He held on. But the Presley Walkers went under, and Sam Walker had to. Well, he was ready to retire anyway, and so his place left. There were, I think, five big farms. They some of them survived, some of them didn't. But the Schlotzauers, were interested. They once the I wish I knew her name, the lady with the baby little girl, they moved to Sedalia. They used that slave cabin for a milk separating operation and a Delco electric system, which would give you about one light bulb in each room. Very progressive. I don't know when.
So the Schlotauers, you think these Schlotauers that they did dairying here. They had a dairy and dairy cattle.
Well, some degree, but it's not a good dairy farm. It's mostly good for grain. And they're still farming it because they, of course, have handed down the acreage through the generations, and the present owners do soybeans or corn. And we sit in the middle of it. We're probably quite a nuisance. But
so when do you come back into possession, Winky,
of
these
my
7 acres?
Her mother was born here, and they would come visit uncles and aunts and everybody. And I remember she'd drive by and look wistfully because this was the family home, and it was no more. And out of the blue, they had retired to South Texas, had a great grapefruit orchard, and were very engaged in down near Alamo, Texas, where my mother's father had settled. And but it got to her, so they talked Virgil Wolf into selling them just this one little patch with all the broken down buildings. And of course, the windows had been boarded up. It was a mess.
And by what time is this? What year?
What year are we talking
about?
This would
be about 69 or 70.
Okay.
And what a mess.
And the property is at that time owned by someone whose last name is Wolf.
Yeah. It was inherited by Frances Wolf. She had been Frances Schlotzauer. And then she married Virgil Wolf. Yeah.
So your mother wanted to come back to the
plantation. Oh, of course. But it was just supposed to be a summer fun place. I had lost my husband, and we would come up here in the summertime, and we'd patch plaster and sweep and reglaze some of the windows. There's a lot of our handiwork in this place. And of course, since I was an only child, at her passing and my father's, it was all here. Different relatives would send in furniture that had originated here, which was nice, because the Schlotzauers had moved away Uncle Ad's furniture. Of course, Uncle Ad liked high Victorian, which is just as well. But when the furniture had been divided in the 1870s, a lot of the descendants sent their old furniture back here. So, but that's another story. But the main thing is, it was pure sentimental remembrance. And I ended up here because after Mother died, we had live-in help. Papa lasted another 10 years. So my husband and I stayed up here because the help needed a break now and then. And she had a boyfriend, so her weekends.
When did your mother die and you begin to live here permanently?
1985.
And had you already begun to live here permanently, or no, only after her death?
After her death. Mm-hmm. And because Papa lasted another 10 years. And as I say, the help needed weekends off. Mm-hmm. So, and then after Papa's death, my husband was failing. So within 2 years, he was gone. And I just stayed here. Should have gone back, but you get rooted.
And gone back meaning where? If you had gone back, where would you have gone back to?
Covington, Louisiana, or Mandeville. Mm-hmm. I was beginning to lose my friends. They were moving on into nursing homes and everything. So, and I was a little lazy. Emptying all of this stuff. Impossible. So I'm staying, and I'm going to give Sarah the pleasure of it someday.
Well, I think you have become quite a well-known fixture in this community within probably a 40-mile radius around here. You are well-known. So talk a little about your social, your religious, and your community associations and the folks that you have built a life with here since you've lived here.
Well, number one, it was my curiosity. I have never lived in a place yet that I didn't have to know why it was like it was. And my first thought here was, why did all the family leave? What, you know, why did they come here in the first place? And I started, you know, I read a wonderful book by, not a book, it's a manuscript, by a Mr. McVeigh of Sedalia, who had access to the best railroad information and history. And he wrote a wonderful manuscript on the history of this area and why the trails went the way they did. Anyway, but of course I can see how they all left when they couldn't have any help, too big a place to run alone. And I found a fella, sufferer, in Ann Betridge. They had bought up Crestmead, or her family had, and they were restoring it. And school kids would come out to see the restorations. And it hit us both. The kids would come and say, you know, maybe 15, 16 kids, and we'd tell them something about the Civil War. Civil War? They were from Missouri with neutral. And so Anne and I got together, and we decided we got to clear this up. And one way to do it, of course, would be to have a little pamphlet to hand out to the school kids. Well, Anne had been a teacher, and she liked to write. She said, no, let's do a book. Well, anyway, in the meantime, we invited four or five other people over here one Sunday afternoon, to start a historical society, because we needed an organization to try to do what we wanted to do, to educate everybody about what is here and what should have been here and what wasn't. People didn't know there had been an army encampment down in Otterville, which had affected the way...
Would that have been a Confederate Army encampment or a Union Army?
No, Yankees.
It would have been... It would have been a Union Army encampment.
Right. Mm-hmm. They had to have help down there because they were trying to put in the Pacific Railroad, and it was coming through Missouri. And, of course, they didn't want anybody burning the bridges. They had to build those bridges out of wood in those days. And so they set up this big army called Camp Curtis down in the, I think that's right, down in the outside of Otterville, where the bridge was crossing the Mean River. And it was a pretty serious bridge. And they didn't want the Confederates, or the, we can't call them Confederates in those days, they were State Guard, and burning it, because the railroad was carrying supplies out as far as Carthage, and down in there it was.
And of course, in this history, you're talking about what time frame that you're talking?
Oh, I bet the 80s.
The 1880s.
No, the 19. The camp down in the.
Yes.
Oh, that was started actually before war was declared, I think.
So there was a Union Army encampment just outside of Otterville, prior to the Civil War starting. Is that what you're saying?
They hit Boonville first in 1861 in the spring. By July, General Lyons had an army out of Iowa, and he was marching down to Wilson's Creek at Springfield. Okay. Reason they wanted this railroad to go through is to supply these different union
forces
and protect the railroad. In 61, their bridge over the Osage was burned. They burned it on the way, the St. Louis local guard burned the and tore down the power lines that went west.
You're calling these local guards, but that isn't any official name. What you're referring to, and this is a question, what you're referring to when you say the local guard, are you referring to these rebel Confederate sympathizing soldiers, or whom are you referring to?
I am referring more or less to what the way the picture was in 1860. There were these German marching societies in St. Louis, and they had big groups, and they would march and play war and have balls, and it was a great life. There was also the National Guard, I guess we'll call them the Home Guard, that did their little thing too. The German Vereins spoke only German, and but you know how Germany always loved to drill and play soldiers. It goes with the territory. But when things were, they had a meeting in the Planters Hotel in St. Louis when General Lyons and the governor of the state met. And the governor said, we can't be federal. We want to be what we are, neutral. And General Lyons said, well, that means war. General Lyons said, you have to join the Union. And so within 3 days, Lyons had, do y'all know that story? Had loaded up 3 steamboats full of these German soldiers and started up the river. Well, the Missouri people didn't know about that. They got together in St. Louis and started marching west. They could never catch up with those steamboats, but they didn't know. But they burned the bridges and they cut the lines and did everything to be a nuisance to get to Boonville, because they were going to form an army at Boonville. Mm-hmm. With, General Price was supposed to be here. Mm-hmm. It was supposed to be a big, big get-together. But, of course, what happened, the Germans got off that steamboat in Boonville almost a whole day ahead of the St. Louis fellas that were coming out. But they were a pitiful, the locals were pitiful. They had rabbit guns and things like that.
Missouri was, the history that most people understand is that the worst fighting of the Civil War took place in the state of Missouri. The bloodiest fighting. Yet the Missouri Compromise happens in 1820. And so Missouri's never, the agreement was with the compromise that Missouri could become a slave state, but that caused all kinds of problems from then on, so that kind of gets me back to Pleasant Green.
Pleasant.
So your family, they were, what would you consider them, having been Confederate sympathizers?
I think everybody had kind of their own ideas. Down at the cemetery, the ones that went for the North and the ones that went for the South are sleeping in happy company, and long live the Union. But the Walkers that lived here during the war, that would be Anthony Smith. He was in the legislature at the time General Lyons says, this means war. So he was getting kind of old to be signing up for the army. He came home because the legislature had been dissolved, and most of them went west and got together out in western Missouri to form a new government, which is a whole nother 2 or 3 day talk. But when he died after shortly after he got home, so he was out of the action anyway, but it left Mary Elizabeth with 17 mouths to feed. Mm. But you were asking specifically about
the sentiments in your own family. I mean, this was this was a slave plantation.
Well, Ed was a Yankee. He joined the Home Guards, and he and Nathaniel Leonard, I know they had a big time galloping all over the county, scaring people. Ed was a hunter. He loved whiskey. He was a whole different breed of cat, and he was the next generation. He was my great-grandmother's brother, and her husband would have nothing to do with Ed, because Ad loves guns and everything, and my great-grandmother was a peace-loving person, and her husband was a doctor with the Missouri people, and he hated guns. So the families started had a split there, so that's where my blank spots are. Mm-hmm. But you wanted to know specifically about the black people, right?
Well, I wanted to know if there were descendants of the original slave families and slaves that were here, if there were still descendants that you were aware of.
Yes,
in this community.
In Sedalia. And I went to the funeral of one, I guess about 12 years ago. She wanted to come home and be buried. She had married a fellow, a teacher, and she had moved to Chicago. That was the place to go. And she had three sons, and she wanted to come back to Sedalia to be buried. And I got to go to the funeral. And then there's another family there, the ones that didn't want to talk. Then they're probably more in Kansas City, because I know some of the Walker family moved to Kansas City, and they kept in touch. And I must admit that I was in Little Rock, Arkansas, and I was not too involved in that.
So let's come back up to 1985 and thereafter, when you're actually living here at Pleasant Green, and talk about how you become involved in the community. And you mentioned earlier about
these. Society.
Uh-huh. So let's talk about that group and what happens with them.
Well, we got off to a hilarious start. We put up markers and did the little, what started out to be a pamphlet for the school children turned into a book this thick. Anne was an inveterate writer. I got to do the illustrations, and it was fun. She said, okay, this is going to be the story of the town of Pisgah. So she gave me a space this big to fill, and I'd be filling it. It would get smaller and smaller and smaller, because Anne was an enthusiastic writer, and she was writing in 8 or 10 point type and double spaced, so it'd be easy for the kids to read, you know. And it ended up, I'll show you a copy.
What was the title of this book that you produced? Discover Cooper County. Okay. And what did this group that you're calling the Historical Society, did they call themselves the Historical Society of Cooper County?
The Cooper County Historical
Society. Okay.
Right.
And does it exist to this day? Does that exist to this day?
Yes. We've really had to cut back, though. We have a research library in Pilot Grove. We own the building. But, of course, with restrictions nowadays, one thing we did, we would have a meeting every month, and it would be in a different part of the county every month. And we would usually use one of the local churches. And There are some fabulous churches in Cooper County. I don't know how many of them are still operating, but that was where we had our meetings. It got people to travel around the county. And we would have events. I did a bunch of calendars with pictures of local sites. We just did everything we could to raise money. And this book was quite an expense, but it came to pass. And so every year, Ann Bettridge would go to all the schools and pass out copies of this book to all the schools. I think there are 12 schools total.
Let's wait for the bell to ring, and we'll clip it out. This is just wonderful, by the way. I'm really enjoying learning about the history.
We had a lot of fun.
Oh, it sounds like it.
We had garden tours, home tours.
Yeah.
Put on keys.
Okay, whenever you're ready.
One of the things that directly involved Pleasant Green, one of our fundraisers, we would open up these old houses, Crestmead, Pleasant Green, Burwood, the three of them. Oh, and New Lebanon. New Lebanon has a wonderful old country store that's been preserved. And we would, I got hoops for everybody, and we'd drag out all of our friends and put them in hoop skirts and put them in the different rooms, you know, so that people could wander through and get the flavor and serve tea in the dining room.
So you would dress them up like, say,
Victorian,
Civil War or pre-Civil War,
yeah, mm-hmm,
regalia. Okay,
yeah. Mm-hmm. I made a bunch of them, and it was fun. But it brought in money, and it was a great tourism project. And then bus tours got interested. And so we would get tour buses that would come through as well. And that was always fun because they would pay good money and we could keep that. But when we were doing it for the Historical Society, But we had sometimes we would have as many as 6 or 8 tours during the season.
Tell me about the United Daughters of the Confederacy and how you're connected to that organization.
There was a chapter formed in Sedalia back in the early 1900s, and my grandmother and my mother joined. And then when they all moved to Little Rock, they were very active. There was an active chapter there. And so, of course, I joined. And they put on balls. It was kind of fun. And I can't say I didn't enjoy it. And the UDC still exists to this day. They meet once a month in Boonville. There's a chapter here. And they have programs. It's just a pretty standard women's organization.
How many people belong to the UDC today?
I can't give you...
Here, locally, in Boonville.
I think before the plague... we had about 15 or 20 members.
How long has it been since you've actually attended a meeting of the UDC?
A couple of years.
You haven't gone in a couple of years.
They still have meetings, if you mask. They have a room at this new bank in Boonville, and I assume they mask and sit 6 feet apart, but I have not been active.
What do you think that the UDC has done over the years that you've been involved in?
Well, when they originally started, they sponsored homes for the Confederate veterans. Mm-hmm. I remember as a little girl, there was a Southern Memorial Day, and we would have little bunches of violets, and we would go to the Confederate cemetery and put the violets on the graves. And then they would sing songs and all of that. I don't know whether that's done anymore in the South or not. We don't have any Confederate cemeteries up here.
Are there any Confederate memorial markers in this area?
In
that were sponsored by the UDC?
I don't think so.
No? Okay.
I think they're an enthusiastic bunch of ladies. Many came from Howard County. You'll find more Confederates in Howard County than Cooper.
Mm-hmm.
We have several members from Howard County. They give scholarships. I'm sure I'll think of a lot of worthwhile things. And they keep a headquarters in Washington. And the programs are very interesting.
Talk a little bit about your connection to the churches here locally and what your family's church background was. And did you carry that forward all through the years?
Well, of course, the Methodist Church started, I'm told, in this house back in 1820 or 21, because they were all Methodists. And then they finally got that church built. It was a log church in, I think, 1823. I'll have to go check the date. Anyway, it was a log church. And part of it was a little school, and part was church. And the first burial, as far as we know, in the old cemetery was 1834. And that was a Walker nephew who had come west to help the family settle. The Methodists became the dominant little group. Well, of course, Cooper County is that way. You'll find over that way, they're all Presbyterians. Over that way are Baptists. Over that way are Catholic. Cooper County is sort of that way. But for myself, personally, and my mother, we joined the Episcopal Church. The reason being, the Methodists in Little Rock didn't believe in any kind of wine or drinking or anything like that. And they were dead set on funding South America, missionaries to South America. And I remember at a meeting, we were told to donate to send to the South American missionaries because the natives were dancing on Sunday and drinking. And those missionaries had to be there to straighten them out.
Oh,
and of course, myself and some of the girls I was sitting with, we had danced into the morning, Sunday mornings, many a time in Little Rock, Arkansas. Dances didn't end till 2 or 3 in the morning. And I didn't feel like it was fair to go down there and tell these people, you've got to start partying at 12 o'clock. So mother and I both just joined the Episcopal Church, and their rule says, eat while drinking, in moderate amounts, and wine is okay. I mean, that's sensible, you know. Just don't make a mess.
Talk a little bit, and this is going to be the last question for today. Talk about a little bit about your political affiliations, yours personally, and historically, what were your political affiliations and why, or what was the thinking behind that, those affiliations?
I didn't really give it a lot of thought. My grandmother, I guess she would have been a Republican because she was dependent on J.P. Morgan for income. And my mother was a little bit of kind of like her mother. My father, he was raised here in High Point, Missouri, and I'm sure he probably was brought up a Republican, if you want to define something as that, but it never amounted to anything. I went to the University of North Carolina, and which is a very liberal university. We were always pretty liberal. And I don't know, I really never gave it a lot of thought except the financial aspects of it. My grandfather thought Roosevelt was going to ruin the country, and I heard a lot of that. And of course, the WPA, we lived by a ravine, and the WPA fellas were, one of their projects was to build paths in this ravine for exercise and everything, and they were doing beautiful work. They would come up and need water or food or something, and Mother always gave them a piece of buttered bread with sugar on it. And but see, this was the Depression, and everybody was poor. But my grandmother resented it. She felt like we were supporting these people to build paths, and they should be doing something else. I don't know. You get a lot of noise from relatives.
So your family, coming out of the Civil War era, were Democrats. Would that be right? And at some point, well, that was the party of slavery, right. were the Democrats in those days, and the Lincoln was a Republican,
in Arkansas was a Democrat, mm-hmm. Democratic. We just didn't know what Republicans were. And now that you mention it, after the Civil War, Reconstruction was rough in Little Rock. The Yankees liked it down there, the climate, and they built, during Reconstruction, four absolutely tremendous Victorian mansions by the river. And we would snort every time we would drive by those houses because they were carpetbagger houses, we called them. And one of the biggest automobile agencies in Little Rock, now we're talking 1930s and 40s, one of the biggest automobile dealers was the son or grandson of some of these carpetbaggers. And Mother would not buy a car from Rebsamen because his ancestor, he came down there to smother the natives in Little Rock.
Well, how do you describe carpetbaggers? Talk about that.
People that that come rushing in after a tragedy to make money.
So after the Civil War.
Yeah. Although these fellas had probably, Little Rock was occupied. They had a black legislature, and they hung a couple of local fellas that had been spies, they thought, and David O. Dodd, road named after him. I had a horse named after David Dodd, because we had been repressed by the Yankees Union, and so I'm sure that nobody even considered Republicanism.
So after the Civil War, Winky, your family felt that the North had really oppressed and repressed the South.
My grandmother probably had stronger feelings than my mother. Mm-hmm. Mother was so busy trying to help Daddy make a living. He had a radio station, and the Depression was a hard time to have a radio station and a farm paper. And politics really never involved. I remember I was in New Orleans when Landon ran for office. Now, this is New Orleans, Louisiana. And all the girls in my class wore Landon buttons, and I had to have a Landon button. I didn't know what a Republican was, but I wanted a Landon button. But that's a whole different community.
Mm-hmm. So your family, even though Lincoln was Republican and freed the slaves and Reconstruction happens under the Republicans, at some point, though, your family is, and to this day, you are a Democrat?
Yeah.
You consider yourself a Democrat?
Yeah.
Describe how you think of your Democrat heritage.
I wish I had more time to think about that.
Well, we can talk about it next time, too. But
I'm under the influence of a lot of what I'm reading now and the feelings that are out there now. And if one person is for something, somebody has to object. There has to be a knocking of heads. I have this son that flies for Delta. This has nothing to do with politics, but it's the way people have turned out. This lady got mad at the stewardess because the stewardess told her to get her mask on. The lady knocked out the stewardess. And then another passenger got into the fight. They had to land and let this woman off the plane, hoping she wanted to get to Houston. But I don't know whether she ever got there or not. They started in California. He says usually on the East Coast, people are meaner than on the West Coast. Usually they're all pretty laid back. But this gal got on in Oakland, I think, and headed for Houston and just made a terrible scene.
But that made national news, right? That's the one that made national news?
No, this one hadn't been in the news yet.
Oh, okay. Another one. Oh, dear.
Yeah, that one got off in Kansas City. This is a different one.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, let's think about that some more, and we're going to take up with that when we when we come back together in a few weeks here. We're going to think a little bit more about the political affiliations of your family and why you think those were there and how that's changed over the years up to you. And we won't talk about that today anymore, but because you'd like to have some more time to think about it, you said. So let's do think about that some more. And then we'll take up there when we come back.
Thank you, Winky.
It's great. It's just terrific.
Sorry, I can't stay on the subject.